ערב טוב, good evening. It's the last evening of the retreat. And I'll switch to Hebrew.
Okay.
I'll translate. I tried. ואני רוצה להגיד תודה בשם כולנו. I want to say thank you in behalf of us all for everything that you conveyed to us through the questions, through the interest, through the deep engagement we felt from you in the practice and in the Dhamma. Of course, we experienced already through Wada how every question can be taken to respect all the depth that it can open a door to. But we will not be doing that in the question and answers period. We will be reading your questions, letting the question drop within us, and respond. So it will be more like a gesture of wisdom, a gesture of love, a gesture of what the Dharma and how the Dharma lives in our heart minds, given back to you. So in advance, I want to you know, ask the questions that will not be read. You gave us so many questions here. Really wonderful ones. And we did not decide to pick only the wonderful ones. We decided, like in life, to put them all in a ball. And we see, we put the hand in. That's what we get now, and we'll answer.
I was just having a short reflection on the very idea of questions and answers, which is it's an interesting topic in itself. I mean, what is a question? So the mind, well, there are different kinds of questions actually, and you can see it in yourself. That all of us have different type of questions, and sometimes the question is like something is the kind of the unhappy mind that something is troubling it, and you think, oh, I'll ask a question, maybe I'll get an answer. So it kind of, it throws the authority. To project, it's really projecting the authority to someone, you know, with sitting here as if we have the answers for all this. Which could have been great, right? Well, but it's, yeah, for whom? Yeah, exactly. Grateful for whom. But also, the whole process of the retreat is based on many questions, like, you know, what's going on now? What can I learn from it? And we're sending ourselves back to experience and back to meeting the wisdom that comes from within, also from outside. So we hear wise things from our friends here, from the teachers, from previous retreats, from other things. And it exists within us, and we kind of open to the question. Sometimes we get an answer. So it can lead to many. So I just wanted to have this little reflection, also to take the tension off myself, needing to answer, you know, giving an answer. So we'll see how it unfolds, how everything unfolds.
There's a really easy way. When I announced it, I didn't say question and answer. I said question and response.
Oh, yeah.
So we are responding, but we're not necessarily giving an answer.
Let's begin.
Yeah.
האיכויות של ההתעוררות גם הן זקוקות לתנאים כדי לעלות להתעורר. כל התנאים כאן, בין דור, העיניים הטובות שלכם, המורים וההוראה. מדוע בכל זאת אתם חוזרים ואומרים שמדובר באהבה, חמלה, ללא תנאים, איכויות שאינן תלויות בתנאים וגורמים חיצוניים? The qualities of the awakened mind heart also need conditions to arise. And to come into being. All the conditions here in Endor, the good eyes of you teachers and the teachings and all. Why do you still keep repeating and saying that it is all about boundless, unconditional love, compassion?
You're looking at me.
I was wise to translate it to English.
So the conditions for understanding the Dharma are many, and some of the conditions we have here on retreat, of course, and the meditation instructions are conditions, but we have the conditioned and the unconditioned. We cannot make ourselves wake up. We reach the limitation of the conditioned mind rather quickly. So this is why direct understanding through experience is so important, because that's when we can know this wonderful knowing factor of the heart-mind reveals the unconditioned. This is why I talk about the boundless and vast and immeasurable, because it takes us beyond the ordinary everyday self, which is limited and narrow.
Is it possible to have romantic love without attachment? Romantic love seems to be contradicting liberation. Is it possible to have both?
If it hurts, it's attachment.
So simple.
That's it. Keep going. Next question.
I was just thinking, if it's ecstatic, it's also attachment.
But that's not hurt.
That's not hurt. No, it's not. So go for it. If there is no continuity, what does steadiness consist of? Some steadiness of views, etc.? And what cultivates steadiness?
Yeah. Well, some questions begin with a premise. If there's no continuity, I mean, who said there's no continuity? There is continuity. Things unfold in a continuous way. So that's causes and conditions assume continuity. So it may kind of make the whole question change if you can change the perspective and not assume what you think or what you kind of, it's a thought basically, or construct. I would leave it there, actually.
So the
witnessing of continuity of causes and conditions of the whole process. So rather than being stuck on things, we allow ourselves to be in the process. And then it's free. I mean, the process is free. That's it.
I remember the first time I saw a movie. We had the home movie, and I could see the light, and I could see the film, and I could see the projection on the wall. And sometimes I'd take a piece of paper and paint on the paper what was projected by the projector, and then I was so proud that I really had a nice picture. And I filled the picture with my paintings. And I think we do that. So you will hear views. Asaf said, who said? And I wanted to say, my experience told me that there is no continuity. And sometimes also things happen slowly by slowly, and then they happen as if all at once. And we think it's abrupt and sudden. But also if we take a big step outside of the event, we can see all the processes leading to it. Like, when does a tree fall? Or when does a flower bloom? Or when does a person die? When he's born? When I was in Bhutan, they said that the consummation of the child begins in the heart mind of the parents long before they copulate. So, process. And what do you, when do you think, when did this retreat begin? When will it end? And I think it will not end. And in that way, the process will go on, because sometimes a moment you will rethink the retreat and suddenly you will remember a sentence, a subset, an inquiry Radha made, and you will relive it again. And it will be so, no beginning, no end. We're always in the middle. That's my response.
האם אנחנו באים עם ייעוד תפקיד לעולם? והאם הדרך בה אנו מתים קשורה לסיום תפקידנו, ייעודנו בעולם הזה? ואם כן, איך ניתן להסביר מה בתחזרי? אלים. Do we come to this world with a destiny, a role?
Yeah.
A purpose, thank you. And is the path and the way in which we die in relation to the how we finish our purposes and destinations in this world? If so, is it possible to explain a cruel, violent
Well, remind me of the first part of the question again. It was about free will or
purpose. We have purpose coming to that.
I don't know. It seems to me that from my understanding of the teachings, that it's neither free will nor destiny. The middle path is the unfolding nature of things, and we see this process, and what matters is our response to the unfolding process of this life. And if we respond with wisdom, then our life becomes rather different. Go on.
So, what can a cruel, violent death be explained?
The Buddha said if we tried to figure out karma, we would go crazy. Trying to explain all the causes and conditions, which are vast and many, that would lead to one event. And it's the same with a cruel and violent death. I've seen a friend of mine, who was the most beautiful woman, die a very painful death. And to me, there seemed no explanation for that.
Well, the exploration, this is an exploration, the last part of the question is an exploration of somebody else's karma. And the Buddha said about that, it's really not a way to go because you won't get your head around it. And it creates pain. But the exploration of the first part of the question, I think it's really worth asking for ourselves. How did I get here to this retreat? Was it my choice? Was it the self, the I, who kind of chose this way and paved this path and arrived here? Or was it something else? All the causes and conditions in my life that kind of were brought together and allowed it to happen. Maybe starting at a very early age, maybe before I was born. So it's worth asking the question, not necessarily Asaf sitting here giving the answer, but exploring what do we know from our understanding and experience. I can tell you from my own perspective, just a personal, that the way I think about it changed through life and with the development of my understanding and experience. So even the view or the understanding can't be fixed. I mean, can't be fixed or hold on to anything. There's no one answer that is the right one. But I could really see how as a young person, I thought this way, then I changed and I had different perspectives and it evolved and developed. Maybe the same for you.
Can you speak more about shame, guilt, and unworthiness? I think those as a big hindrances. I think of them as big hindrances for me, and would like to get the Buddhist views of it.
Your question.
Well, I'm grateful for them. Imagine a world with no guilt, with no shame, when we know we have done wrong. Imagine how we would feel when somebody bullied us or shamed us and we would not feel ashamed. Of course there is shame. Of course there is guilt. And of course there is also the potential to understand through our own shame and guilt how delicate we want to cultivate us to be when we speak, when we listen, when we act, when we meet. Because people might get shamed or hurt through us, and we wouldn't want that. So we learn from that. That's the ground from which deep understanding and respecting of humanity is, the pain in it, and the liberation that is possible.
Beating ourselves up for things that are not worth is can be painful, and we need to be, we can be mindful of that. I really like the translation in the Buddhist text of there is a term for what we can translate as shame, or but it is actually more like what's called regard for consequences, of understanding the consequences of something that we did. And if we have clarity about acting wrongly or acting rightly, so I have clarity, so we can understand the regards for the consequences, and we can feel something about actions that really hurt somebody, and it helps. It helps our development. But of course, if it grows into like something that's more obsessive or kind of the self is invested in perfectionism or something like that, then it's, yeah, it needs some attention, meditation, letting go, and connection to other qualities, joy and freedom.
How can I make any meditation go deeper?
I don't know. Ask good questions. I mean, ask good questions about the meditation. What is this? What's going on? I really want to know. It's a way to go.
A poem just popped into my head. Don't be so shallow as to only look for the depth.
Once in Australia, somebody came up for an inquiry and she was really angry with me. And she said, "Your teachings, Radha, they're so shallow." And I just laughed and I said, "That is the first time anyone's ever said that. Bravo." I usually have the opposite comment. We can't understand you.
So, yeah, I mean, I just think if I would be the one asking the question, I would feel it unanswered now. And that's okay. Just to know that when we talk, because we can get also engaged and really in our own fun of friendship and being and the love of Dhamma. And then the person asking the question may feel left out of the fun and the touch of heart. So that's the nature of this gathering. That's the nature of the Sangha. And we are one Sangha, so do see also our simple people that we are.
Yeah. Yes, and it really gives also some light on the form of this, as we said in the beginning, question and answer, question, no answer, question and response. But and in my kind of daily life, I'm more used to the interpersonal, as we had here a lot, the inquiry. So when the question, now kind of reflecting on the question of how can we make meditation deeper or something like that?
Yeah.
I would really like to inquire into that. Like, what do you mean by deeper? What constitutes deep for you? How do you think about depth, or what's your experience of depth? And we can go from there, right? It's and then it's, yeah, it's you feel it's easier like this. It's we can and internalizing something from that exchange means that we can do it also with ourselves. So when the teacher is not present or a friend is not present to have that experience, so we can, what would it be like to have that question and then, inquiry. It's possible.
Yes. I'm loving this.
She's the conductor of the orchestra.
How do we come back from the retreat to an environment that often speaks differently, leads off screens, lots of screens around, like telephone, television, for, you know. That will be answered tomorrow. No.
Maybe.
Okay. I often wondered about that. Why do we keep such a difference? Because, you know, actually, you know, the everyday life was present here. It was present here, of course. We got up in the morning, we looked at the tree, we walked, we saw, yeah, we didn't. Anyway, what I want to say, maybe it's not, I mean, believing that it's really two different worlds and we are stepping from one world now into the other can be a really big pithole, because it may also be something else. So we will talk about it really tomorrow. Living more and more by the Dharma is also taking me apart from people that were very, very dear to me, and in a way, I am more alone. If there was a second paper attached to it, I just picked the one, so I'll consider. I mean, that's a full question. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it can happen. I mean, it changes not only internal life but also external life. It changes the way we kind of conduct ourselves and the kind of things that interest us and the kind of conversations we want to have. So just acknowledging that. And sometimes, yeah, you can go through a phase of disintegration of the known, and hopefully something else is created out of that.
I think we as human beings love to connect. And so sometimes when we go down the Dharma path, it does set us apart from some of our old friends. And so life shifts and changes. But what the Dharma offers is an extraordinary group of practitioners, the Sangha. And I am totally wonderful friends with people I met 50 years ago in India. And of course, I meet many more along the way. But the Sangha is, you know, so rich and so deep. Yet at the same time, I live much of my life in a very remote place. And so there's a lot of solitude in between the teaching. And it's important that solitude doesn't become loneliness. And so I think there's a difference between feeling alone and feeling isolated, which leads to depression, and really enjoying the preciousness of solitude. So it's a balance, I think, between solitude that breeds reflection and really seeing into life, and this extraordinary heart-to-heart meetings and our connection that we have with people.
איך להתמודד עם הופעה של ספק בחיים?
Jewish.
How to deal with the appearance of doubt in life and in practice.
Well, doubt manifests itself as a wavering of the mind, one direction, the other direction, this or that, and make a decision. And so about the practice, it can come up as a practice thing. Is this path for me, not for me? Is it working, not working? I want to do it, I don't want to do it, all that. So it's just seeing it to some extent, just see it as a manifestation of confusion. And actually not, the doubt has this tendency to convince us that there's something real, that and we just need to think more about it. But of course, thinking has the characteristics of this and all that, this or that. So it just contributes to more of that. So there comes the answer and advice, really, is to look for ways to go out of the thinking into something else, and to kind of rely on something else, which is not the thinking mind and the I feeling that, you know, everything depends on whether I decide this or that. Because it's a belief, it's really a belief system. It's a belief that, you know, it's so important that I make the decision, as if this clever mind knows exactly how the future will unfold from my decision. So the opposite of it is trust, trusting. And it's not trusting the thought process that brought the confusion, so trusting something else. And I think the retreat environment gives us clues and hints to something different, and we can do that. And also we can get kind of closer to people who have less doubt and less confusion, and it helps to have the connection there, just as a reminder. It's not that they have the solution for us. It's they remind us of the possibility and the qualities that already exist in us.
There was a period in my life when I only felt doubt, and I couldn't trust my own mind or my own decisions or movements. And then I decided, for both the practice and life, to listen to others and to say yes for some time. And that's what I did. And luckily, there were good others, and I just said yes. In the path and the fellow Sangha and volunteering and doing things in retreat. I said yes to whatever was offered. Yeah, that's also, sometimes you can just say, okay, whatever will come to you, try saying yes and see where it takes you.
Yeah, I did the same. I had the same thing in my life.
Yeah. Please, more about how to deal with rage, anger, criticism, and manipulation from someone who is inside your family and makes splits against you. It's not easy to address aggression. It's not easy to find a way to meet it and to not leave the house altogether or the family altogether. Sometimes we need to do that, to leave the family or the house and to go where we can get more support, more encouragement, looking into our own capacities, and then see what to do about it. I only want to say that don't be alone in it. Look for people you can talk to about it.
And yeah, support is possible, of course. There are, yeah, even writing it in sometimes in the diary is important. And I know there was an important moment when I just looked into the eyes of the, you know, someone was really being abusive. Really looked him in the eye and said, "You're hurting me." And it helped me to acknowledge and to say and to have a voice about it. And last week, my son told me something very sweet. His small son said to him in the morning, he was having a, you know, an argument with a wife he loves, but they were speaking in harsh voices. And so the little one, he's almost six now, on the way to the kindergarten, he told him, "You know, Father, I want something to tell you. When you speak in this tone to Mother, my heart aches." And my son was, with the immediacy that he could afford, to just kneel on his knees and hug him so, and thank him and say, "Well, I really thank you." So sometimes, you know, we have teachers also. Is walking meditation equal to sitting? Also in the outcome it brings?
Of course.
I'm just continuing really. And is mindful yoga can be an equal to walking meditation? במהלך הריטריט, during the retreat, ולפעמים גם בבית, and sometimes at home, השינה וההרדמות אינן באות לי בקלות. Sleeping and falling asleep don't come easy for me. The mind and me are awake. How can I enable this time to be easier? How can I invite sleeping and falling asleep?
Yeah, no, I'm actually not the right person to ask because I no really I mean it's not about bragging or anything. I fall asleep easily, but I wake up easily, so I don't have the problem of falling asleep, but my sleep is light and I can wake up early or in the middle of the night, and then I don't fall asleep immediately, but I don't mind. I mean, I just, you know, I sit, I sometimes I read, or just, you know, have my thoughts or something. I don't perceive it. Maybe I was once, I don't remember. I definitely nowadays don't perceive it as a problem. That's me. I don't know if it kind of answers anything.
Well, I have a friend called Iran who lives in, you know him also. Just now with family, he has a Facebook book, and he is an expert on how to help meditators fall asleep. Really, that's what he, so that's his expertise, helping people. Tell him I just contributed to the good living he makes out of being an expert on sleep and falling asleep. He's really helpful. So, actually, I think the only word I can say is don't worry, but sometimes we do, especially with the thought that comes, tomorrow I have this special thing and I will not be fresh enough. Actually, when we were preparing ourselves towards this talk, we felt a bit tired sometimes. And we talked about, wow, and what we maybe you can take the lead, or maybe you can, and because I would be too tired. So we also have these experiences, and they're just thoughts. They're not experiences. They don't, like, we come here and, oh, where is the tiredness gone? So we don't know. As we said, take a step, but he will fix me up.
I think for those people who have trouble falling asleep, one of the main difficulties is the I thought that comes in with all of the projections into the future. On retreat, for example, it's never a problem because we're just sitting around all day. And I say, never mind if you don't sleep. It doesn't matter. And so that frees us up a whole lot to not worry about the fact that we're awake during the night. And much can come of it. I fall asleep easily, but I also, like you, wake, and I often get up during the night, or I can even watch a movie during the night, or do read, or whatever. Doesn't matter. So there's freedom to be awake, freedom to go to sleep.
Next question.
Yes. I often feel like I only wait for the next moment to arrive, never really present. How can I do that? Or how can I go and not wanting all the time to be somewhere I'm not? Really, all the time? I'm really asking the person now sitting, do you want to be somewhere else right now? Sometimes we drift.
I think it's a rather lovely question because it points to a movement of mind that we're also familiar with, the leaning into the next moment before it's occurred. And our meditation is just very much about presence, about being with the direct experience that we're having right now. And the experience itself is seeing the mind leaning into the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, just emphasizing this. I mean, it's the seeing itself of the mind leaning into the future happens now. And also on a relative term, sometimes, you know, these retreats and what we do, we shrink the length of time. So we may kind of live in life, I remember, like waiting for the children to grow to reach a certain age or something like that. So it's a big chunks of time. And in retreat, it gets shorter and shorter and shorter. As you said, okay, I wait for it just to be the lunch. And then you say just not even lunch, is the bell to ring. And then not just the bell to ring, but just to have this experience moving on. And we are constantly reminded that, hey, actually everything's fine like this now. And we train ourselves to go back to that. And even now, sitting here, I'm thinking about this, you know, the next question. Like, let's get to the next question, as if this question is, you know, it's just, we can relax into that. We can spend now, you know, an hour just talking about this. Why not? Without having that, and it's not a coincidence that we laugh at it because it's funny, and there's a release in, let's just, you know, enjoy this moment. It's a lovely moment. Yeah, it is a lovely moment.
Hmm.
Next question.
Feeling full of love without an object to love means what?
Feeling full of love without an object to love means being in love with life. It means boundless love. It's extraordinary. Love with no object, the end of all concepts. Wonderful.
Yeah, it immediately, it's like with this moment, right? It brings, can you hear? It brings the attention back to the love instead of the object. To the love itself and this movement of the heart that is love. And it's not dependent on any particular object. So it's great. So bring it back home.
Well, I was once a student of philosophy, and right now, I think there is always an object. The object can be the whole world. That's also, but seeing that that's the needs of the mind comes into being by creating an object. I'm just saying, let's learn how to preserve the life of the object. We create. It's not about having an object or not having an object. It's not that where the difference lies. The object itself can come to life in us, in our love, or it can be dead in our life. Like this is an object in my here. And it can be much more than that when I'll see it in with love. So love is what makes both objects and less evident objects come to life and enrich my life both outwardly and inwardly together. Just looking at the cloud and loving the sky. That's object. They can become an object. So life can be dried out of love or infused with love. So let's infuse life with love.
This is not at all a lovely poetic answer like you just heard, but mindfulness always has an object, awareness. Needs no object.
Dear teachers, I'm noticing that yeah. That although I have had experiences, I feel complete with them, and
the way I take them. So, a talk by Bhikkhu Bodhi, and he had this, you know, this microphone here and microphone there, it said, oh, Bhikkhu Bodhi has many attachments. I'm noticing that although I've had some experiences, I feel complete with them, and the way I take them to my everyday life and don't really feel the need to inquire about. But then I see all the beautiful sharings and get jealous and also want to share. Thought it's better to write truth if I'm going to write something. So there you go. It's not a question, really. It's fantastic. Yeah, beautiful sharing. Thank you. It ends with much love. Much. You read.
מה אני עושה עם הרצון האז בבן זוג כדי להרגיש פחות בודדה בעולם? רצון שמחלה את נשמתי ולא נותן לי נחת. ההשתוקקות הזאת לאהבה וקשר אינטימי והדרה גורם לי לקושי וסבל יומיומי. What can I do? What am I to do with my insistence, strong will for a partner so I can feel less lonely in the world? The will, this wanting is burning out my soul and doesn't give me rest. Desire for that love and an intimate connection causes me daily suffering and pain. You know, I meet people. The people who live lonely share with me the anguish of loneliness. And the couples I meet share with me the anguish of living with a partner. but also the power of imagination is sometimes too weak, because we fantasize. I mean, each of us, I mean, there is a core of loneliness that even the most beloved child or partner, it doesn't dissolve completely. So, and actually it serves a really important message for life, that we are both so deeply with everything, but also specific and alone. And just try to think about life and your conditions. Keep looking for a way to see it in an unproblematic way. It's like, it can be like a nuscha, kilu, anchaya. Okay, I see it now as problematic. Can I also see it as non-problematic and just hear the answers that come up? Amos Kanan has a very, which is an Israeli poet, he has a very beautiful short poem saying, you can have a sip of tea with a mountain. You can have cuddle with the moon. You do not possess anything. Please, don't make loneliness your possession.
Somebody told me today that the mountain was her father and the sea was the mother. And I thought it was the most beautiful expression. Vimala Thakur would say, the language of the mountain and the earth is love. So if we can see in this way, it helps with the feeling of loneliness and aloneness.
So let's see.
What came to me as I'm just sitting here with you all is that love asks for nothing in return. It's fulfilled in itself. So thank you very much for your questions and for the enormous love and appreciation that's been shown to me and to us over the days. Thank you.